Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from the super secret underground bunker, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 132 of Registry Matters. Larry, do you have the COVID from flying?
I probably do.
Oh my God. So we need to keep probably not even 6 feet. I don't know that would be sufficient. We need to keep maybe like 30 feet.
Well, what are we right now?
Across the room? It's probably 15 or 20, maybe 20.
So, all right. Well, we're doing the best we can
with what we've got. The acoustics in here are always amazing. And what is the super secret underground bunker?
It is a residential facility in the county of Butts. So you people that are looking, all you have to do is hit every residential unit in Butts County, Georgia.
There's only like 30 people that live here.
And you'll eventually find us.
We have a handful of people in chat. We have voicemail messages to play. We have possibly a 911 call to play. And a crap ton of articles. So we are just going to go dive right in. Is it hot enough over here and humid enough for you here compared to back west?
Well, it's only in the low 90s. What do you people expect this time of year?
I would expect like pretty much this. Not too long ago. It's been very cool. So yeah, I would expect roughly this.
So who do we have in chat tonight that I can say hi to? I don't see them on my screen like I usually do.
We have a Theresa. Oh, Teresa. And we have a Tammy and a Will.
So, alrighty.
That is the big crowd this evening. Well, this first article comes from The Appeal, and the title of it is Coronavirus in Jails and Prisons. And this article is, I put this at the top just to give us a quick little update on where things are as far as, is it still spreading rampantly in prison? Is it, you know, so this is just more or less just like an update of where we stand on things. So, Larry, where do we stand on things?
Well, it's I didn't read this article, but I would imagine from what I'm hearing in the news, it's escalating at a lot of institutions.
Yeah,
is that what the article says?
It hasn't abated. Is pretty much the answer. It's like the worst conditions that you could possibly be in is to be in prison. More cases, more people getting infected. They're not able to clean. They're not able to separate. They're not able to get masks. It's pretty awful. It's a pretty dismal situation if you happen to be locked up. You know, much like the situation you describe in the for that riot, if you were there, if you got out on the 28th versus the 29th in your state.
Yes. Well, this doesn't take any particular level of genius to figure it out when you have people clustered together in conditions that are not less than ideal without a pandemic. Sanitation and cleanliness is less than ideal. And there's so many things that work against it. Those who've listened to the podcast, we talked about early on in the pandemic. Your laundry is very restricted, at least in most facilities I'm familiar with. You don't just go to the washing machine and do your laundry. You have a laundry round that picks up laundry once a week or twice a week at best, and you're limited to your access to laundry. Water is designed to prevent flooding of cell blocks in housing units. So water is restricted in terms of it flows with time limits of anywhere from a couple of minutes to maybe 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly having to push the buttons. The flow is not strong in most situations. They're trying to conserve water resources. So you got all these things working against you, and then all the proximity of people being close together, and then the lack of cleaning supplies.
Hey, you know, there's something funny that you just reminded me of. I was thinking about some of them, like the faucet will flow kind of in an upward direction and then just sort of spill out.
Yes.
And I've seen that in some, like in the more elegant kind of high-end hoity-toity kind of designs of things where it'll like fill into almost like an aqueduct, and then like you have this flowing water to wash your hands, but it's definitely like a more voluminous amount of water, but it's just this like trickle that it would drive you absolutely bonkers.
That's why I'm prepared for, and this time I only had to adjust one of my rooms that I stayed in. The other one was adequate.
Well, that's good to hear. Did you have any battles with any critters?
Critters? What type of critters?
Insect types of critters. Undesirables.
I haven't had any battles with any that I can think of, no.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if you would want to bring up talking about any sleeping critters.
No, I don't know anything about that.
Okay. All right, then. Well, anyway, so the prison COVID situation is still dismal. That is pretty much all we really even have to say about it. If you are in prison at this time, it would be, I can't even imagine how people are like hanging out in the day room or something. They probably have t-shirts like wrapped around their faces. People probably get twitchy about being near anybody else. So it just has got to be awful.
Well, we would have to be losing lives that didn't have to be lost by people that had they been taken out of the environment, they would have survived. Of course, everyone's not going to die that gets the virus. We know that. But we also know that within the vulnerable population, that the rate of severe, the severity increases with age and with medical, with pre-existing conditions. If you look at the number of people who died, many of them have pre-existing conditions.
Right.
And we know that we've got the prisons, particular in the states that have three strikes laws, where we have a lot of elderly people who have not been able to be released because they're not eligible to be released. And we're going to keep them till they die. And I guess in that regard, it'll relieve the state's problem a little bit sooner.
You know, we have an article coming up talking about that, where someone said, I don't care. And that person had a lot of pre-existing conditions. So maybe he got what he deserved. Maybe he shouldn't have been fleeing from the police.
I don't see a problem with that.
Absolutely not. Well, let's jump over to another article. It's from The Appeal as well. And this is Minneapolis City Council members announce intent to disband the police department, invest in proven community-led public safety. I've been hearing a whole lot of things about this one, and maybe this even ties into, I think it was a city in New Jersey. Oh God, I can't think of the name of it. Do you know off the top of your head? It's on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, they did a community policing thing in New Jersey. We could probably spend a whole lot of time, because even you and I had a conversation earlier in the week about who has the authority to do this. This is the city council has a veto-proof majority saying this is what's going to happen. And please tell me that you can explain this better than I would understand.
What particular aspect did you want to explain?
So the city council can then just go, hey, mayor, we don't want the police to be this way, and you're going to follow our committee of veto-proofness?
Well, it would be a veto would work just like it would work in at a state or federal level. Say on a 9-member council, I'm pulling this out of air because I don't know the number of the size of the council. But if the city charter requires a 2/3 majority, and if it were a 9-member council, if you had 6 councilors, you would just override the mayor's veto. So you would pass the ordinance, the mayor would issue his veto, the mayor would plead with people to sustain his veto, and he would be looking for 4 votes because. If it took a 2/3 override to override, 6 votes would be the magic number. So he would be looking to, his magic number would be 4. So he would be making all kind of promises to prevent the override. And when they vote to override the veto, then the legislation, the ordinance would become law over his objection, and it would be as if it had been signed.
This I think there's a lot of confusion in the way that this is worded, that that they're saying that we're going to, quote unquote, dismantle the police department, which is probably true in the literal sense, but not true in the actual sense. They're not talking about having anarchy with no sort of law enforcement agency. But in the end of one of the paragraphs, it says, we can resolve confusion over a $20 grocery transaction without drawing a weapon or pulling out handcuffs. That you could, you don't deploy the police for every different difficult kind of transaction that you would have with people. From, you know, I was driving up here and I saw 6 police officers had somebody pulled over. I don't know if this person had some sort of vest on that would explode. I don't know if the person was just having a temper tantrum, but did they need 6 police officers to handle the interaction? That you could build in different units to handle domestic abuse, traffic tickets, you know, and have, okay, fine, we have some sort of serious threat that we do need weapons and we can call in that department to handle it. I think that's what they're actually trying to describe.
Well, I think they've had some ideas about unifying the Hennepin County law enforcement, which is the sheriff's department. I don't think they have a county police department. That seems to be a distinctly southern thing, where they have a county police department and a county sheriff's department. But I think, as our guest said last week, they're looking at one option to bring in a unified enforcement from the county. But they're not going to go to having no law enforcement. But what this would be, it would be, we've given up on being able to reform the department that we have, the existing apparatus. It just needs to be dismantled. And that's exactly what needs to happen in many cases. It's very difficult to reform an existing bureaucracy. I think if we want to spend some time on this podcast, we could talk about businesses that have failed because they were not able to transform themselves.
Certain.
This is not just a public sector thing. I would argue that Eastern Airlines doesn't exist anymore because it was unable to reform itself to reflect the competitive nature of a change industry. The power structure within the union, within the machinists, and within the flight attendants union, within the airline pilots union, they just were not able to adapt to. We had gone from the era of the Civil Aeronautics Board setting fares to a competitive where the airlines were able to set their own fares, and it was competition, supply and demand, and the cost structure that had been built up. When there was protection of fares and protection of routes, and the only thing you could compete on was basically food and how you pampered your passengers and how pretty your flight attendants were, which they called stewardess in those days, it was a whole different world. And they were not able to change. Now, the consequences weren't that people were dying and being tased and beat up, but the culture was too entrenched to change. And that's what we have here with Minneapolis and many police departments. They are not able to recognize and to effectuate the changes that are needed culturally. They're just not able to do it. They've got too many of the old guard. They've done it this way too long, and the union is too strong. And we have a union article coming up later about how unions stymie effort, the police unions stymie efforts to reform. And it may be that disbanding is the only option.
Can you backtrack just a little bit that you brought up something about there could be a county police and county sheriff? To me, I use those words interchangeably.
Well, in the state of Georgia, many counties here in this state have the county police. So if you pick up the phone, you would call, if you're in Clayton County, you would call the Clayton County Police Department. But Clayton County also has a sheriff's department, and the sheriff's department has responsibilities, including running the jail, serving civil processes, summonses, and they don't typically engage in day-to-day law enforcement operations where they have a county police department. That's distinctly Georgia. I have never lived in another state where there's county police, but they are all over the state. This particular county, I'm not sure if Butts County does have a police department. I don't think they do. But the next county up, Henry County does. Clayton County does, Fulton County does, DeKalb County does, Cobb County does. They all have county police. Well, when you have county police, then the sheriff's office backs off of law enforcement, and they would serve a backup role if the Clayton County police requested them. If the city of Riverdale, which is in Clayton County, or Jonesboro, one of those counties, said we need help, they're fully certified law enforcement, and they can provide law enforcement. They can do things, but they typically don't, because they've got municipal police within the cities, and they've got a county police department that does basic law enforcement.
That's pretty confusing.
What's confusing about it?
Oh, just the delineation of, I realize that they have a separation of powers, that this one does this one thing, but like you just said, you've never lived anywhere that has these overlapping things with just a different name. So it's just...
Well, I'm not so sure that it's distinctly Georgia, because I've not lived in that many states, but I didn't see it in New Mexico. I didn't see it in Michigan. I didn't see it in Colorado. I haven't seen it in other places. You know, they have a county sheriff's department, and then they have their city police where there's incorporated cities, but I've not seen what they refer to all over this state is the county police, but they do have them here, and they probably do have them in other states. It's just I haven't lived in enough states to do the comparison. But it's not that complicated, because they define what the responsibilities are. In Georgia, even though the sheriff doesn't do where they have county police, although the sheriff typically doesn't go out and do road patrol, they could if they wanted to.
Right.
The sheriff is technically the chief law enforcement officer of any county in Georgia, and the sheriff could put a patrol division on the street, but the sheriff chooses not to, because if the county commissioners have funded a county police department for the purpose of providing basic law enforcement, the sheriff's department is not going to go out and duplicate what's already being done. But the sheriffs in this state in particular can do almost anything they want to do. So
yeah, and then also you just said something that you don't know a certain thing. I thought you knew everything.
Everything that's worth knowing.
Oh, I didn't realize it was. Oh, okay. And who's the arbiter of what is worth knowing?
I am.
Oh, okay.
But I wouldn't be surprised if New York doesn't. I mean, New York probably has county police. I bet if Charles were here, he could tell us that. But I know it's very common here in this state.
I wonder if some place like Pennsylvania that has like counties and boroughs that they.
I know Maryland does because I've heard about the Montgomery County Police. I don't think it's distinctly Georgia, and so I didn't mean it that way. But it's not widespread that you see it in every single state.
Okay, then let's move over to what is this law360.com and hey man, this is some bipartisan support that you always grill me on and say, oh, here's some of your bipartisan support, and you say it with a very contemptive tone. But this is a quartet of senators has put together trying to make it so that our people, and those our people are the ones that have any sort of felony, could apply for the payroll protection program or the paycheck protection program. The funny thing about this, though, Larry, is that when does the enrollment for this thing stop?
Very soon.
It's June 30th. Yep. So I can't imagine Congress doing anything to get anything through. Here it is, the 13th. So they're going to have, 27 days to get their act together, and then someone's going to have the wherewithal get down to their local office to fill out the paperwork for this?
Wouldn't it be 17 days?
Is it 17? 23? 17? 17. See? Don't do math on a podcast.
And I don't mean to imply that all bipartisanship is bad. What I'm trying to stress is just because it's bipartisan doesn't necessarily make it good.
I think you just want to poke fun at me.
Well, I do, because we assume mistakenly that something bipartisan magically translates to good. The Adam Walsh Act was bipartisan. International Megan's Law was bipartisan. A lot of things are bipartisan, and that doesn't translate to magically good. So you can have good public policy derived that is bipartisan. You can have good public policy result from something that's highly partisan, because that's the way the system's designed. You're supposed to have a winner, and the side of an issue that can muster the majority votes usually has to compromise with the minority to get enough votes cobbled together to represent a majority. And throughout that process of compromise, you often can have some very good public policy. But just because it has bipartisan support doesn't necessarily make it good. This is something that would, in fact, be good if it were to happen.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because they're going to have 2 weeks to get attached to it. And they've already spent $500 billion of the $600 billion that's allowed for in the program. No one is going to qualify for this. There's not enough time and not enough money left for anybody to get anything.
Well, if it comes to pass, it would be a good thing.
Yeah. You know, I'm with you. I just like, this is like too little too late. The ship has already sailed and all that hokey pokey stuff.
Well, if we were to, for example, if we were to have a second flare up and they were had to pump more money into it, if we have, it would be something good to set the foundation for later, that we don't automatically disqualify people because of something that they've done in their past.
Do you think that something like this would then carry over?
It could. We could be having a debate right now. Well, not this now, but in this era, we could be starting to have a debate about, is it fair to penalize people from having access to taxpayer subsidized services when they're on the up and up? I mean, these people are employers, for God's sakes.
That's kind of one of the reasons why it really makes no sense that even in the article, it says we should celebrate folks who have done exactly what society asked of them. They turned away from crime. They started a business to support themselves and their families and contributed to their communities. An estimated 1 in 3 American adults has a criminal record. And because people with records often have trouble finding employment, many of them have gone on to start their own businesses after they've paid for their mistakes. So then wouldn't we want to reward them and go, hey, man, thank you for getting your act together and not committing more crime. Oh, by the way, we have this pandemic. We need you to shut down. F you. You don't qualify for any money.
Well, all what you said is true, but it's not only FU, and it's FU and the employees of that.
True.
Of that
oh, entity. Totally, totally. Yeah. So, hey, oh, FU for getting employed by someone who went to prison.
So, yeah.
That's tragic. Super tragic.
I don't understand that type of logic. I would want like I say over and over again, I would want these employers to survive, because if we're to have this rebound that we're hoping for, people need, employers need to be able to survive and put people back to work so that taxes can start being paid, so we can stop running. This deficit this year is going to be, in my prediction, since we were at a trillion baseline before COVID-19, I'm predicting between a $4 and $5 trillion deficit this year.
Yeah, I think I heard 30 by the end of the year, maybe.
Well, you're talking about the accumulated national debt.
Yes,
I'm talking about this annual deficit for this year. We were at a baseline $1 trillion, which had doubled from what that had been inherited from the Obama years. The baseline budget deficit was $1 trillion. And when you start adding up all these programs with a 2.2 for this and 800 billion for that, you're going to add at least $4 trillion of spending. But that doesn't tell the whole story. You also have the decline of revenue. All federal revenues are going to be down. If you've got 40 million people not working, you're not getting Social Security and Medicare contributions.
Right.
If you've got 40 million people that are not working, you're not getting the federal unemployment tax, which is a very modest tax, but you're not getting that money. And yet you're adding trillions of dollars of spending. If we don't have a $5 trillion deficit this year that ends September 30th, I will be amazed if we don't have a $5 trillion deficit.
And those programs, at least the Social Security one, is funded by the current contributions, if I understand how things work.
Well, it's funded by the current contribution to the extent they cover, and then we draw down from the trust fund to the extent those contributions don't cover. So it's a combination of that. And the trust fund is money that has been accumulating running surpluses for the last 30 years.
I understand. Anything else here that you want to go over before we cover the next really amazing, outstanding article?
No, I'm just hoping that these employers actually do get to participate in the PPP, and I'm hoping that people's jobs are able to be saved.
Yes, without a doubt. That's totally, totally true. But over at the Tennessean, part of the USA Today network, Tennessee wants to put a man to death despite evidence of racial profiling during trial. Oh, God, there's a Supreme Court case, and I hope you'll remember the name of it, where they decided this, that you can't use race as a jury selection.
I believe that was Batson.
That sounds at least close to what I remember.
Well, Google Batson, somebody, and I believe it's the Batson case.
And they're rearranging furniture upstairs there.
It's actually the ice maker.
That is a very, very loud ice maker. It sounds like it's dumping ice on the floor.
Well, the pan was empty, so that's what it's doing. they emptied the pan out for some reason.
Oh, it probably had COVID on it. But this is a man who has spent a truckload of time. He was convicted in 87 for a murder, and he's not. I mean, he's brown, Larry, but he's not like a black man, like a traditional. And I hope I don't sound offensive there, but he's not like, you know, the typical like black person that we have in the United States. He is from another country, and he got convicted, and there was like lots of racial biases and so forth. There was only one black person on the jury and so forth. Anyway, so what else is going on here?
Well, the state is arguing that the trial was fair enough, but if it was, I think it was Batson, but the
Jen Supreme, says, yes, it was Batson.
Yeah. The Supreme Court said that the prosecution can't use their peremptory challenges. Those are the challenges that don't require a reason to be stated. You just say, you're excused, thank you, have a great day. And prosecutors would do that to exclude minorities. So if you were in a county that was 80% white, 20% black, and you had a black defendant, well, the jury, the number of people in the pool would be very small to begin with, because the black population is pretty small in the county. So the prosecutor would have enough peremptory challenges. They would just excuse anybody that was in the pool and end up with an all white jury. And the Supreme Court said you can't do that.
Right.
If you're a prosecutor, you can't do that to have an all majority jury. You just can't do that anymore. But it wasn't the case back then.
Right.
So.
But then would that not be brought forward to now terms?
Well, I'm not really sure. You know, does he get a new trial? I didn't get to dive into this to find out exactly what all the states are arguing. But the point that you can make clearly is that if we were the just society that we claim to be, we would want to eliminate this as being an issue. If he didn't get a fair trial because the prosecution excused all the jurors that they thought would be objective, when you're going to put someone to the electric chair, which that's not why they're doing, but if you're going to take someone's life, wouldn't you want to make sure they got a fair process?
I would think so. And I would also think that, like, we would not want to have that black eye.
We don't seem to worry about international opinion when it comes to us. We are quick to criticize other nations, but when it comes to human rights issues, like young people on the registry, like what we have 11, 10, 9 years old is the youngest. But
yeah, something like that.
When we get criticized, we just kind of blow it off.
So we will move over to the next article. Back to the appeal. This is I can never be more grateful. After nearly 35 years, Willie Mae Harris is released from prison. Harris is now 72 and blind and had been serving a life sentence for shooting death of her husband, a man she said had abused her for years. Last month, the Arkansas Parole Board agreed to free her. She's super excited about getting out of prison after being in prison since 1985. So what's that, 35 years? That's crazy. That's a long time.
Well, we're going to have to give credit to the governor there. Asa Hutchinson agreed that the time had come, and he had previously said no, but he changed his mind. And as I have said repeatedly, and I'll say again, he has the political capital to do this because he will not be vilified by any Democrat politicians for letting her out. When you see these Republicans leave office, a former Arkansas governor that ran for president, Mike Huckabee. You remember he did a whole bunch of clemency?
I remember the name Mike Huckabee.
He became a media sensation. I think it was Fox. I don't know if he's still there. But then the governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, they do these things and they take very little criticism. I think the attorney general, I can't imagine Mississippi attorney general be a Democrat. But I think he got a little bit of grief from the attorney general when Haley Barbour was on the way out the door. But Asa, for whatever his reasons are, he did the right thing. She was in prison long enough, and she's not going to be a threat to society. And he went ahead and made it possible for her to be released, and she's eternally grateful. Now she's only got 35 years of parole to do, so she's off parole when she's 107.
That's nothing, man. She should be able to do that, like, with her hands tied behind her back. Wait, hang on. I probably shouldn't use that metaphor.
Yeah, it says Harris will be on parole for 35 years and at the age of 107, according to her attorney.
That's crazy. Well, and I do struggle with those kind of things that she claims that she was abused by her husband, and then at some point, like, the tipping point just came and she smoked him and then goes to prison for first-degree murder. And given all of the truths now about so much domestic abuse and whatnot, that it's just probably another thing of the times that, of course, you know, it's almost like if you're a woman in a marriage back in those days that you were just considered the property and there was no reason for you to shoot your husband for beating you, like, you should just take it.
Well, it says in the article, though there was evidence that could have proved the abuse, Harris's attorney, that was her, who were court appointed, presented none of it. Harris was the only person to testify in her defense.
And it was a court-appointed attorney, right? So she had a public defender?
Yeah, and I don't know that was the reason why they didn't do anything. It's the common belief if they have a public defender that the public defender doesn't do it because they're a public defender. There could be strategic reasons, but it is bizarre. But nonetheless, I'm not even getting into that. 35 years and she's 72 and blind.
Mm-hmm.
It's time, folks.
Yeah, she probably can't do much damage on the street.
So Governor Hutchinson did the right thing.
Outstanding. Over at the New York Times, we say, how police unions became such powerful opponents to reform efforts. Do you know, Larry, that there are certain people that they have an appearance and they, like, it's almost like their job is then picked for them because of the way they look? This dude that is the head of the police union looks like one of those people that is in charge of a police union. half a decade after a spat of officers involved deaths inspired widespread protests, many police unions are digging in to defend members. I think this was more or less about the don't cross the blue line. Is that the right expression, where the police officers won't turn on themselves?
Yes.
And you know, so somebody gets accused of doing something wrong, then no one will say, yeah, I saw him do the bad thing. And the police unions, I've heard a whole bunch of podcasts about this lately, of how much the police unions, with the contract negotiations and how they fill out paperwork and they can't get fired and their records are sealed from public scrutiny. I can't see how this survives. I just can't see how it survives.
Well, it's an amazing thing that police unions, I don't think they're like traditional union membership is pathetically low in this country. And the unions that exist are largely very weak compared to their heyday. But yet the police unions are strong, almost as strong as ever. And people that are union leaders tell me that they're not a typical union. And I can't explain the difference, but it's amazing that they have the power they do. And part of that power is the fear that they instill. They have the ability to scare the hell out of you about bad things that we talked about last week on the podcast about what they will do to make you fear any changes. They will convince you that you're not safe anymore.
Right. And I watched something today that I can't remember where this was, and I just watched it on YouTube, so take it with a grain of salt. But cameras, like 13 cameras inside a police precinct, reports come in of looting and rioting in XYZ town, whichever one it was, and all the cops just sit there. They sat there for hours just twiddling their thumbs because, like, you know, they're getting so much pressure that they're overreacting. Well, we're going to underreact now. See how you like that.
Yeah, they're teaching us a lesson.
Right. And I hope that the framework in Minnesota then applies out. Yeah, we'll teach you a lesson too. Like, you don't have to hit everybody with billy clubs that crosses you. I saw another video of someone, he said some pejorative to the police, and they came over and just squirted him in the face with their pepper spray.
Well, those 57 officers in Buffalo, initially we were hearing that they resigned. They actually only resigned from the emergency response team.
Yes, correct.
And they're still collecting their six-figure salary. A former police chief, I had saved the clip with intended of playing it. He said if they resign and they don't accept the assignments that the chief's given them, that they should be fired from the force altogether.
Sure. That doesn't sound like that big of a stretch.
But yeah, they were making a statement to, again, that's designed to scare. Well, we just won't have an emergency response team. We'll show you people. If we're not going to back us, we just won't do this anymore.
And then there's another paragraph in here. It says politicians tempted to cross police unions have long feared being labeled soft on crime by the unions. And those are big voting blocks, and they would have a lot of bully pulpit. Is that the right term to even use in this case?
They would definitely have access to almost nonstop media coverage. If the police leadership is telling you that the community is in danger, that is going to be covered. That's news. I tell people when you have officials, whether you agree with them or not, saying that things are dangerous, what do you expect them to do? Well, we don't really think it's all that dangerous. We won't cover that. They're going to cover it.
Yeah. I don't know how you fix that one. I mean, because, you know, like Larry Krasner, so the guy that got voted in Philly to be a progressive DA, how he seems to have won on the platform of something more close to equal and justice and whatnot. And he gets trashed in the media pretty regularly. How do you combat that they have that kind of platform?
I think education. As far as the media, they're going to cover it because it's news.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, that's kind of their job, and they're driven by ratings.
But would you like them to be the arbiter and say, well, we don't think we're doing that. Let's see, we've done our analysis. Oh, well, the community's not that much danger. We're not going to report that. They're going to report it. If the police say this community is in jeopardy because of these reforms, they're going to report that. It is news.
But you say, are they going to be the arbiter? They're already the arbiter. They pick and choose. Now, of course, this is a newsworthy thing, so they're going to cover it, but they pick and choose other things that they don't cover.
You know, that is correct. But
you talk about the 1,000 people that get shot by police every year. They don't cover all of that.
They don't cover all of them, but if we didn't cover it, we wouldn't know 1,000 people got shot, would we?
I think that happens to be from the Washington Post, like, collecting statistics, because there's another article we have coming up, that there's no centralized information on what our local police forces do.
But in your local community, you know when your police are killing people.
Sure.
Yeah. We know when every time there's a police shooting in Albuquerque, we know. We choose to have different levels of reaction, but we know. But I'm saying if the police are saying that these reforms are going to make this community unsafe, that is news. And it's going to be reported.
Yeah. I don't know. This one, how do we have a group of people that carry the weapons and they have so much access to the media and they get to tell us how safe or unsafe we are? And then we make policy decisions based on what they've said without necessarily any evidence behind it because they didn't report anything because there's no reporting requirements.
Well, I mean, if people want to stand up and say the community is safe, they'll report on that also. They'll say, well, the district attorney says the community is safe, or four city councilors say the community is safe, but they're not going to ignore when the police are saying that bad things are going to happen. They're going to report that. That's news.
Sure. Well, then let's move over to another New York Times article. Democrats to propose broad bill to target police misconduct and racial bias. How in the world, Larry, can those federal government people tell my local police department how they should or should not act?
Well, literally, they can't. But what the federal government has is money, which local communities want. And therefore, in order to get the money, they can attach conditions to the local communities. But as far as telling a local community how to run the police department, they really can't. They can say to meet federal standards, just like they do with Adam Walsh Act, in order to meet federal policing standards, if you want your burn grant, you will do these things. You will act in the following fashion. But they don't have to do it. They can say, you know what? You can take your burn grants and you can do whatever you want to with it. Yeah, I've made that argument many times. It's about the school lunch program. I heard so much criticism about the National School Lunch Program standards, about how Michelle Obama was dictating. No, she wasn't.
She was just saying you'd get this batch of money if you follow these guidelines.
If you want the federal government to feed your local school children, which that's the buckle where all the lunch money comes from, is from the National School Lunch Program federal funds. If you would prefer that the federal government feed your kids rather than you taking your own responsibility at the local level and you feeding your own kids, then you have to meet these standards. But you can tell the federal government, we don't want a dime of your national school lunch money, and you can feed the kids whatever you want to feed them.
And do you think the sheriff in Butts County is going to turn down that money?
I don't think very many. Law enforcement wants all they can get.
Now, tell me this one other thing. Are these the same people that bitch about any sort of government handouts?
They typically are the people who preach self-reliance and individual responsibility. But see, they have an argument. I mean, I'll go ahead and tell you what the argument. The argument is, well, we pay our taxes to the federal government. We pay our federal taxes. And all we're doing is getting some of that money back that we've paid. And if we didn't pay the money to the federal government, we wouldn't be asking for that money back. That's their answer.
I guess they would be required to pay it regardless of them receiving the benefit.
Well, that's the silliness of the whole thing, because regardless of how the federal money is allocated, you're going to have federal taxes. So whether we allocate it to law enforcement or to national defense or to whatever programs, there's going to be federal taxation. But they justify it. They won't admit that they're being hypocritical. They will say, well, we're entitled to our share of the federal money. Well, we shouldn't just stand down and let the other states get it. I mean, we're entitled to our cut. That's what they'll say.
And I wonder then, we've covered the article a number of times where the women get shackled when they're giving birth. Why do we have to make certain kinds of things like chokeholds and knees in the neck? Why do we have to make any sort of law that would actually target those kind of things? Shouldn't that already be like, we ought not do that?
You would think so. But I've come to the conclusion when I see so much that there's not enough internal discipline within law enforcement to do those things on their own initiative. I would never like to see children, and when I say child, I'm judging them by their size and strength. If a person is 12 years old and they weigh 190 pounds and they can bench 300 pounds, and I don't really consider their child emotionally, but they're not a child in terms of physically. But when I see a crying 9-year-old being handcuffed with hard steel handcuffs, when the 9-year-old looks like they might could lift 40, 50 pounds if they're lucky.
Yeah.
And that the average adult could hold the 9-year-old's hands until they completely exhausted themselves from running out. You know, when a child is fighting, how you can hold the child and they'll eventually completely exhaust and go limp. If you do it long enough, they will completely run out of energy.
Sure.
It may take a while, but I wonder, why would you handcuff that child?
Mm-hmm.
But they do.
Mm-hmm.
So since they're not able to impose their own values and say, I wouldn't want my child put in handcuffs at this age. I'm not going to put handcuffs. No, sir, chief, I'm not going to handcuff this child. I'll take a neck scarf and I'll tie his hands, but I'm not going to put hard handcuffs on. That's what we do with adult criminals. But they won't. Nobody will say, no, sir, or no, ma'am. Right. I mean, the chief doesn't have to be a sir, but nobody will say, no, I'm not doing that.
So it says the federal police misconduct statute currently makes it a crime for an officer to willfully violate an individual's constitutional rights, meaning prosecutors must prove an officer acted with the intention of depriving the person of their rights. Democrats plan to propose lowering that standard of criminal intent to knowingly or with reckless disregard. And they say that this change is likely to face opposition from police unions and their allies. What would be, tell me what, so the willfully thing, like, I think I can kind of get that one, but how is willfully versus knowingly or with reckless disregard? I keep saying that wrong.
Okay, with reckless would be that you're being careless, but you didn't have a state of mind of actually wanting to cause the harm. Your negligence and carelessness caused the harm. And so it's a much lower standard to prove that someone was willful is a tough standard to prove.
Is that almost like beyond reasonable doubt?
Almost, yes.
So just like armchair judge for a minute, if you would, you know, back Monday morning quarterback for me, that the situation with George Floyd, the dude, like where would you interpret that to be? Did he willfully violate the guy's constitution or did he with reckless disregard?
Oh, I'd love to have the reckless as a standard. If
no, I know that you would love that, but do you think that he willfully did it? Or do you think that threshold is still like kind of murky that you could kind of argue that he didn't do it intentionally?
That's exactly what this defense is going to be. And that's what makes me frightens me about the prosecutor upping the charges because of the difficult standard. I want a conviction and I'll look a person in the eye and say, we want this person convicted of something. I don't want to risk a not guilty verdict. So I don't want to reach higher than what the evidence
right.
sustained.
Okay.
When you have to show, I don't believe we have any evidence unless he had kept a diary somewhere that he had been using force on people and he hoped that they died and his diary reflected that they didn't. So I don't think we're going to be able to show that he wanted that outcome. But we can show that with basic police training that you would know that depriving a person of oxygen has the potential to be very detrimental to their health. So you don't want to over prosecute. You want a conviction. I would much rather him go to jail for 7 years than to go free.
Okay.
Because he gets to be a convicted felon, he gets to serve time, he gets to be away from his family, and he gets to do some reflection on his behavior. He gets to come out and face not having a career. He gets to have to compete for a job, and he gets to be labeled.
And he won't qualify for the payroll protection program.
And so I'm not concerned about him spending decades and decades in prison. I want him to be convicted of something because I want the message to go out to officers because we're not going to have an overnight change in police culture. I want the evidence to go out to officers that if you do this type of behavior, you will be charged and you will be convicted of something. And if you don't like the idea of going to prison, and so we get back to, I would prefer with the prosecution where the likelihood of a conviction is far more certain and with these reduced standards that they're talking about. But that's a bunch of liberal Democrats. Now, you got to remember the liberal Democrats don't control the U.S. Congress. Who controls the Senate?
A Republican.
Particularly who?
Mitch McConnell.
Yep. And
the most he is the worst human being on the planet. Maybe not the worst human being on the planet. But Kim Jong-un is worse. But this dude is way up there, top 10 list.
He's definitely has.
He has power. He knows how to use his power. Like there are other people that you could say have more power, but they don't necessarily know how to use it. He knows how to use it. He's very strategic. He's methodical. He frightens me deeply.
Well, on the federal misconduct statute, I'm reading the same. You are makes it a crime for officer to willfully violate the individual's constitutional rights. The officer is going to say, I wasn't trying to violate his rights. I was trying to keep a very strong man restrained.
But what do you, come on, like, speaking of this specific situation, after he's non-responsive for 3 minutes, you probably could go, he's not resisting anymore, which he, I don't think he was resisting to begin with. But at some point in time, you'd be like, maybe I could reduce my knee pressure on his neck at this point. This is like, I don't know. I don't know how you really get around much of anything than first or maybe not first degree murder, but second degree murder.
Well, what we need to do is we need to next week we need to bring the Rodney King beating video with him clubbing all the officers. Have you seen that video?
I vaguely remember. I remember somebody getting pulled out of a truck, I think, and getting the crap beat out of him.
Well, that was the driver in the riots. That was Reginald Denny. But the Rodney King video that sparked that, there was a group of officers. I don't recall how many, but I think it was in the 4 to 6 officers, and they were swinging their clubs wildly on him.
Okay.
And cameras happened to be rolling and captured. Otherwise, they would have said stuff that wouldn't have been sustainable. But
yeah, 1980. Who had cameras?
Well, it wasn't that long ago. It was in the 90s, if I recall. The police, their defense was that they were only using the force necessary and that Rodney King was in control of that situation while he was pleading for his life, covering his head, mm-hmm. and they were swinging and clubbing wildly. That was their defense. It worked. A Simi Valley jury in California found him not guilty, with him on the ground being clubbed repeatedly and the police saying, we were doing this for our own safety. And then the big old bad federal government came in and they brought federal charges and they actually secured a conviction. But the state jury refused to convict. This is nothing new. It's difficult to convict a cop of anything.
Certainly.
And it's going to be the same situation in Minneapolis. It's going to be very difficult to convict these cops. And particularly if you overcharge them.
Okay. Which is kind of, that seems opposite of what we normally experience, where the charges are accelerated and enhanced to try and get you to plead to something less. And here you're almost describing a lesser situation where we're just trying to get him guilty of something. And well, I don't mean we, but somebody's trying to get him guilty of something.
Well, now, though, I'm not saying the prosecutor might be overcharging with the intent of offering a plea. I don't see the community accepting a plea in this case.
Okay.
So if I'm an elected prosecutor, I'm going to be fearful of offering a deal because the average citizen's not going to understand why you offer deals. And they're going to say, there they go again. There's that corruption that we were feared of. Here it goes. They're making a deal. So the cop doesn't have to pay the price that a regular person, they're giving him a sweetheart deal. And I don't think the community would tolerate that. I think the prosecutor would have an immediate rebellion if they cut a deal. So I don't think you can offer a deal. I'm not saying that that's not in the prosecutor's mind, but I don't believe politically you could offer a deal. You have to convict this cop. But I think the prosecutor has to be courageous and say, if I overcharge, I might end up with nothing. Now, you can always ask for what's called lesser included. So if the jury won't convict on the more serious, then you ask for a conviction on the lesser included of the reduced charge. But I just don't like overcharging people. I really think that's a horrible tactic, and I think you charged accurately. You offer a reasonable plea to everyone, and if they don't take the plea, you go to trial. If the evidence will support it, you shouldn't bring the charges unless the evidence is supported. If they won't accept a plea offer, you try the case.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Now, here's an article from CNN. It says videos often contradict what police say in reports. Here's why some officers continue to lie. This is from CNN. Can you believe, Larry, that there would be video footage and then the officers would say, that didn't happen? They would actually contradict the video evidence, even like in the face of watching it.
Well, yes, I can believe that, because what they say is their standard line. Well, you don't see everything in that video, just like I've heard from people that are dear and close to me about George Floyd. They say, well, you don't know what all he was doing before the cameras start rolling. I can't wait to see the rest of the tape. And I said, well, if the police have tape, why don't they release the video? Why don't we, if the police have all this magic stuff, why don't we get to see it? But the cops, typically, their response is, you just don't know the whole story.
But even if that's the case, Larry, short of Osama bin Laden being on your front door with a vest that explodes, I don't want to say the B word, I struggle to think that the police should arrive at your door and kill people. I cannot fathom the circumstances short of that example I just gave, where there's immediate threat of massive public damage, that they are not the arbiters. They're not the ones that get to tell you that you get to die today.
Well, I agree.
But I don't know how any conversations that are had with anybody. Someone told me I'm just tired of all this stuff that's on the news. I saw something on Reddit, some protester, a white woman, had said, if my, it was listing the circumstances of some of the high profile ones. If my son got put in the back of a van and died, if my son went to the store and didn't return, if my son was just, went to the store with $20 and didn't return, I would be burning up the city too. And I think that that message, especially when we talk about our people, the registrants, the PFRs, the people in return, they go, if anybody messes with my kid, I would kill them. And somehow that doesn't translate to all of these other people have been killed for severely limited, inconsequential circumstances, and they've died over them. We talk about kids with plastic guns and the police shoot them. You can't, I don't know how you could ever justify that into something rational.
Well, it's easy. Officer safety. I don't know what you don't understand. I mean, I'm not trying to be funny. That's how they justify it. They say, well, I didn't know it was a toy gun.
But to have the immediate trigger finger to that be the response to, oh, someone sneezed, I shot him. Sorry, my bad. Someone farted. Oh, crap. Damn, I shot him. My bad. I can't put my head around all these circumstances.
Well, I agree.
I know.
People get shot with no weapons. Some of the articles we have tonight, I think we have either one or two articles where there's a number of them that don't have weapons.
Like this, the headline out of this article is, a video showed officers in Buffalo, New York, pushing a 75-year-old man. Police initially said he had tripped and fell, but then video comes out and shows this dude, maybe he was slightly aggressive, but he didn't threaten the police, and they just freaking billy clubbed him, and he fell over, and then you see blood all over them.
And then they stood and watched. Isn't that sad?
Unbelievable, dude. It's just unbelievable to me that I was having a conversation earlier about this sort of same thing. The police are, to me, we talk about white and black, and traditionally when you were coming up, probably when you were already in your 50s or whatever, the TV show The Lone Ranger, what color hat did he wear?
So, well, that was, I was 107 when that show was running.
So what color hat?
Well, it was white.
Okay, and what color clothing and things did the bad guys wear?
That's so long, I don't know that I remember. It was black and white in those days.
Oh, okay. Well, it seems to me, so white has always represented the good people, guys,
yeah.
And the blacks, and I know how wrong it is to say that, considering we have whites and blacks and other races and colors and whatnot, but... So here in the picture that we have on the screen, the police are wearing all black. And in my head, black is the bad people, and our cops drive around in black cars, and they have all the tactical gear, and they're wearing military garb. They've got combat boots on, and they've got the BDU, the battle dress uniform pants with the cargo pockets. They've got all that crap on, and they look militarized. They don't look like they're community safety people.
Oh, I agree. It's gotten where... The police, it's more and more difficult to distinguish them from a military unit. Mm. It's sad that crime has been getting less and less serious, less and less prevalent, and we've been more and more militarizing the people that are supposed to be interacting with the community.
And of course, they are there to keep us safe. And if, oh my God, something bad is happening, I would like to scream out and go, I would like some help, please. But I don't know that those are the people that are going to come help me either. Hell, they might mistake me. Oh, hey, I've seen your picture on that website. You're on that registry thing. So you must be trying to make something up to get somebody else in trouble.
Yep, you're the bad guy.
Apparently. What's this crazy article from Vice says police are gaslighting us? Reformers say body cameras and video evidence would stop police brutality. Instead, we're being told not to believe our own eyes. This goes along with the same thing that we were just talking about. In Buffalo, police said a 75-year-old man who was walking alone, doing nothing when he was pushed over by a cop, hit his head on cement, started bleeding from his ears, and was ignored by a group of a dozen officers, tripped and fell. And they have several other examples of similar things. How is it that the police can try and stand by that the video evidence it goes against what their story is?
Well, they tell you don't see the whole thing.
Do you see the video on that page? Did you see the SUVs running over the people?
Yes.
We had no choice. We were surrounded. You could have backed up. You could have done nothing. Were they going to break in their windows? Maybe then the police are threatened and they could do something. They would have tear gas. I think that would be an appropriate use of if they're trying to roll your car over and take you out and beat you to death. But if they're just protesters on the street, why did the two SUVs freaking gun it and mow people down?
So, well, they would say that they felt very threatened. It was a menacing crowd and that they wanted to get home to their families.
That's what the asshole did in Charlotte with the Jews will not replace us, and that the Unite the White riot, or protest, whatever that was. Yeah. Do you remember that?
No.
It was right after Trump was elected. It was in Charlotte, and I always forget. I'm pretty sure it was in Virginia. And the rednecks with the tiki torches running around, they were saying the Jews will not replace us. It's highly charged racist kind of things. And so a bunch of protesters, mostly black, but many other people show up, and it was a very large majority of protesters compared to the people that had started the white side of the protest. And anyway, somebody in a Dodge Charger runs down the street the next day and killed somebody, but just mowed the car into a crowd of people.
I don't remember that. My senior moment here.
God, I'm just baffled by this, Larry. Baffled. How about from the New York Times, where Barr says there is no systemic racism in policing? I don't see how you don't see that there's racism in policing. I just don't understand how our chief law enforcement officer at the top would publicly say, nah, there's no problem here.
I think we refer to that as being tone deaf.
That's a fair way to put it. Is it willful ignorance, or is it strategically countering the narrative?
I wonder about that when I talk to people who say that they don't see it, and I'm wondering that if he's lived such a sheltered life,
privilege, huh?
That he doesn't. If you've never experienced it, it's not a relationship. It's something you can relate to. So I'm wondering if he's tone deaf, or if he's just totally oblivious, does he really believe what he's saying?
I've asked this to you a bajillion times about our president. Is he a babbling buffoon? Does he know what he's doing? Is he just an accidental genius of whatever? But this guy has been attorney general before. Is that right?
Yes.
So, I gotta think that he has proven he's competent somewhere in his past, because he wouldn't have just been graduated high school and became attorney general. He would have to have some sort of resume to be appointed. This would be as something of an accomplished, whether you disagree with his politics or not. Someone liked him somewhere along the way.
Well, I have no doubt. I mean, he's respected, but respected people sometimes are oblivious to. See, I take the attitude that no one wants bad things to happen. Believe it or not, whether you're liberal or conservative, contrary to Rush Limbaugh, liberals are not wanting to destroy America. In their mind, they think they're improving America. I do not believe that when liberals attack conservatives, that they want to destroy America. It makes absolutely no sense that they want to destroy America. They want America to be better for them. I mean, people who are succeeding, they want to be even more successful. And when they propose privatizing Social Security, I don't believe they're trying to destroy Social Security. I don't believe that at all. I think that they don't understand some of the ramifications of it, but I don't think I don't think Barr is doing anything deliberate necessarily. He may not have spent any time roaming around the inner cities and watching what happens. That may not have been a desire in his life to learn that.
Sure.
And if nobody's ever said, Mr. Attorney General, you're just flat out out of touch with what happens in minority communities. He may not understand, but for him to say there's no racial bias, to me, all he would have to do would be get into a police car with a hidden camera and watch it on patrol.
Yeah.
And that's all he would have to do. And compare notes as to who gets asked to open their trunk, who gets pulled aside for being in a particular, asking why are you here? What are you doing? And they're doing nothing but passing through. I don't think it would take very long to figure it out that there's some biases in policing.
To go along with that, the acting Homeland Security Secretary, Chad Wolf, said that systemic racism was not an issue for law enforcement. So, I mean, it's clearly not just him, and I'm assuming it's not just the two of them. It probably runs further deeper. And I would also point out that both of these are white men.
Well, there's not a lot of diversity in this national administration.
Hmm. What's up with that, do you think?
I mean, we've got Ben Carson, and what else? Who else have we got?
Oh, God. And he's been there the whole time. Him and whatchamadooiki, the secretary, the education secretary, DeVos, Betsy DeVos, they've been there. They're like the only two people that have ridden the entire time, which I find amazing considering all of the turmoil. But as far as other minorities, like none that I can think of. Jeff Session, he was short. Does that make him a minority?
Well, I'm talking about black. There's no blacks in this administration other than Ben Carson I can think of.
I would agree. Well, then, let's see what's over at the Washington Post, which I might be stuck behind a paywall. Let me try and navigate my way around that one real quick to go over this one. Open incognito, because I can trick the system really well. All right, protests spread over police shootings, police promise reforms. Every year, they still shoot and kill nearly 1,000 people. This is where I was reading this, Larry. It says, that year, the Washington Post began tallying, this is after the Ferguson, Missouri one. The Washington Post began tallying how many people were shot and killed by police. By the end of 2015, officers had fatally shot nearly 1,000 people, twice as many ever documented in 1 year by the federal government. And then they kept doing it in the same, roughly 1,000 people in 16 and 17 and so forth. So they've been like doing their own independent analysis of this to come up with their own version of the total.
It's an alarming number to me. It really is, because again, we lead the world.
Yeah, we apparently lead them in another category there.
So if you were to go to United Kingdom, you'd be hard pressed to find the police ever killing anybody.
Yeah. So what do you think about a manager that I've worked for? He says you can't manage what you can't measure. So if we just sweep all this crap under the rug, then we go, oh, hey, it's not a problem. If we would track it, I guess going back to the power of the purse that ties some sort of funding to it that you have to report this, I don't know how you validate the accuracy of it, but you make police units report in to get some sort of federal dollars. I don't know how else you would report these things. How would you have accurate data to manage that this city is more gooder than another city?
Is tracking a significant problem, because deaths are pretty much recorded.
But don't you end up with the coroner in cahoots and says, God, I don't remember if it was an article we had tonight, but there was an autopsy on someone and the coroner said nothing. Like there was nothing in the autopsy report. So then the family has to go get their own private autopsy. Isn't that even like George Floyd? They said that they found things in the autopsy that aren't true.
Right. But regardless of what the autopsy says, wouldn't we know that the police killed him?
Who would be the institution that reports that happened?
Well, all deaths, as far as I know, in every jurisdiction, are recorded if they're known, and so if someone dies in police custody, I don't know how that the last person who had contact with him, we know whose knee was on his neck, right?
Sure.
We know that he died in police custody. So it doesn't seem like tracking people in police custody that die would be all that hard. Same thing in prison. We know you go into the jailhouse, and we know that if you come out alive, one thing, and we know if you're brought out as a deceased, we would know that. We don't know necessarily what killed you while you're in prison. You could have died natural causes. But when a person dies at hands of the police, I think we have a pretty good idea.
So then by extension, do you believe that this is not accurate information from the Washington Post, that they're tracking twice as many deaths per year than what the government has information on?
I'm not able to explain how that it would be such a variation of them, because it seems like it'd be straightforward. They either died or they didn't.
I get that part, but then the quote unquote cause of death and circumstances, does the family of the deceased have any say in how that is documented? And then how is that information aggregated and produced into a report for someone to go, well, this police department has killed way more people than per capita than this police department? I don't understand the mechanism for that information to travel up the chain of command.
Well, I'm assuming, and this is only an assumption, but I'm assuming that if the, in our state, it'd be the Office of Medical Investigator, I'm assuming if OMI receives report of a death, whether it's in police custody or not, OMI would send out an investigator to do an investigation. And of course, the police would be interviewed. The OMI person would say, well, what were you doing with him? Well, I had my knee dislocated. Okay. What happened next? Well, he went silent for 8, 10, 14 minutes. Okay. Well, then, and I don't know the intimacy of what goes in an autopsy, because I've never observed one. But my understanding at a basic level from what you see on TV and what you hear about is that they take the control of the body and they try to figure out what the causes of death were. You know, if there was a particular cause of death. But the first thing you'd know would be you picked the corpse up at the police department in police custody. You would know that, right? And then you would start looking into the cause of death. You might find that the person had all sorts of issues once you begin an autopsy. Now, we have a person in New Mexico. I can ask more about autopsies, and we can get on next week because that person who's retired now used to do those things. You know, we used to, but I'm assuming that we would know who's dying in the police custody. I guess you could have people that would go into a coronary arrest because they're in police custody, and the police having custody that might not have anything to do with it, their cause of death. But it seems like that there would not be a huge variation.
I can't argue with your analysis there. I'm been conflicted on the Washington Post making their claim that they have tracked, and I don't know what their mechanism of tracking was. Did they just take eyewitness reports and, you know, there's like, hey, I watched Larry die by the police, and they just accept that as being the truth? I don't know how they, I have a decent amount of respect for what the Washington Post does as journalism. I realize that they're slanted in a certain direction, but I don't think that they have been called out terribly for being inaccurate like some other outlets.
Oh, really? For instance?
Even CNN, you know, gets called out fairly regularly for being shoddy. But, you know, maybe there's another one that has three letters and starts with an F and is the name of an animal.
Uh-huh.
I won't be specific about which animal that was. It's sort of like a canine kind of animal.
Uh-huh.
Have you figured out what I'm referring to yet?
It's a little hazy to me, but all righty then.
And then we have another. Okay, so that's the same article. Then all right, that's the Atlantic. If you don't have like a college education, you cannot read articles from the Atlantic. Just about, they use very big words. The first step is figuring out what police are for. This is an article, like I said, from the Atlantic. For reform to succeed, American communities need to have a conversation about what the purpose of police is and think hard about what jobs could be better handled by other institutions. This, we've kind of been tiptoeing around this one. If you have somebody that's having a mental health issue, like some kind of breakdown, and you get the police out there with billy clubs, like that's probably not the appropriate response. But I don't think that we're having the conversation in the country of trying to figure out how we should delineate those roles. I think we had a clip. Maybe it was a clip, or at least I heard someone say, well, we just send the police to do everything. So the police, like everything looks like a nail and they're the hammer.
There's some fairness, in all fairness, there's some truth in that. The police are de facto the problem solvers where we've had either never adequately funded or we've reduced funding for It's like our jails have become de facto our mental health wards, and the jails really don't want that responsibility. And the police get called out when you have a, there's got to be a name for a down and out that's more appropriate, but a person who's down on their luck and who's not completely rational. Guess who gets to call the deal with those people? It's the police. You know, we don't have anybody else to send. So you have a person who may be struggling with mental illness, and this person with all this garb dressed with guns and handcuffs and clubs and everything comes rolling into the scene, and the police officers are trained to talk sternly and with command and with confidence and and that probably escalates a lot of situations. And in fairness to the police, they probably would be happy not to have these roles that have been thrust upon them. But unfortunately, that's where we are with society. We don't have anybody else to call but the police. So that's the article points that out. That, yeah. You know, what do we want from the police to do? Do we want to have less police and more people that are able to respond to those type of situations where you need more of a counselor, a compassionate person, rather than an aggressive armed person? And would you get better outcomes? I think you probably would.
I want you to put on your hat and pretend that you're a particular attendee of the First Atlanta Conference. It says, the crime rate has for several years now been at historically low levels.
What's your response? I've heard that before.
What was the response that the person gave you?
Well, it said it was bogus.
So this must be some shoddy publication, The Atlantic. Psh, who would ever believe anything that they publish?
Oh, obviously not that person.
Can you in your mind lay out how you think it should be delineated?
How what should be delineated?
The police that should, can you think of how we should identify, should how we like quote unquote break up these different roles that they play?
Well, when crime is happening, clearly a law enforcement response is an option to consider, but I think we have to get into, do we really want to send out a heavily armed for a counterfeit 20?
Right.
Had you sent out let's try to see if we can all agree on this. If you had the British model where you send out an unarmed officer, where you should use a lot of verbal jousting and persuasive. If you watch an officer in the UK, then you should try to persuade the person to do what they want them to do. So you'd go up with the British accent and well, sir, could you step into the car, please? You know, would you mind putting your hands over your head so I can do a quick frisk of your body? They're trained completely differently. So I would like to see us send out police that are heavily armed in situations where heavily armed is the right thing to do, because that's what you're responding to. But I would like to see a much more low-key response. They're still sworn officers, but maybe they come in plain clothes, and maybe they talk to you like a friend. You know, hey, I'm with the Albuquerque police. What's going on here? Yeah, and crisis counselors available. Mental health services, of course, that means funding, and we might have to raise taxes.
Oh, stop. We're going to shut it down right now. I'm going to press stop on this recording we speak right here.
We might have to either reallocate some of the money that's going to traditional law enforcement, or we might have to consider increasing revenues to pay for more mental health counselors, more crisis workers, because some things don't need the aggressive response from the police. They need a calming, counseling, therapeutic environment. This is more for Teresa to talk about from PA. But the police are probably willing to give up some of those things because they don't want to do all these things. You know, they're not marriage counselors.
Right.
One of the things the police hate a lot is domestic disputes.
I can imagine that they do.
they hate with a passion because they know that they have to arrest somebody. We've got this famous bipartisanship that you talk about. We agreed that arresting the primary aggressor is required to keep you federal funding. So when you go out on a domestic violence call, you've got to take somebody into custody. and sometimes custody is not the answer, because by the time the police get there, the parties have had some resolution, and they want to call a truce, And they turn on the police, and the police get scratched and attacked and cussed and everything because they're in the middle of this. So I bet we could actually get the police to agree on some things they would like to get out of that part of the business.
Teresa actually did say, she said, defund the police and funnel dollars to mobile mental health crisis units, among other things.
Is Teresa listening right now?
She absolutely is.
All righty. Well, we might need to fire her up.
Yeah, we might. I don't know that we should do that tonight with the internet connection we have. The super secret underground bunker has some really shoddy internet. I've already been disconnected once.
Well, don't let it happen again.
I will try. When I load up new pages for the next article, it takes it like minutes for it to load. But so with that, we're going to talk about, there was a man, a week or two ago that, like a vigilante murder had been killed in, Nebraska. And it says, Omaha man says killing sex offender was justified and doesn't think a jury will convict him. This is from Omaha World Herald. And I have a voicemail message from Will that I would like to play. Are you ready for the voicemail?
I will do my best.
All right. Here we go from Will.
Good evening, Larry and Andy. This is Will from Tennessee, and I have a question regarding the vigilante murder of Matteo Condolucci by James Fairbanks. And there have been GoFundMe pages set up to pay for Mr. Fairbanks' legal defense against the murder charge that's been imposed. And I have read the comments on that page, and they are so vile and disgusting. This murderer has been raised to the level of a folk hero. And there's a Facebook group dedicated to supporting him. And according to the World Herald, thousands of people have supported Fairbanks online. And a store in Nebraska is selling T-shirts that read, Fairbanks did the world a favor. Can those kinds of comments and expressions of lethal sentiment be admitted into court as evidence that the registry does indeed subject registrants to a very real danger that would amount to cruel and unusual punishment? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and thank you for what you guys do, and to all the rest of the world who loves the registry so much. You're such friendly young people. Good evening, and thank you.
Cannot get him to save my life to actually say what FYP is.
Well, I liked it till they got to the very, very end about does the registry cause danger? People, clearly, we've documented that with the ones that have been willing to proclaim that they use the registry as a tool to target their victims. We know that there's the overwhelming majority do not pronounce that, but some have. So we know that. So we know it subjects them to vigilantes, but punishment is a governmental function, and because vigilantes are engaging in unlawful behavior, I'm not drawing the connection that that's punishment. It's dangerous, but punishment would be the punishment that's actually imposed upon you. And the registry is not a punishment that's imposed upon you; it's a collateral consequence of either a conviction or a not guilty by insanity or something that triggers the duty to be a part of the registry, to be a participant in the registry scheme. So up until the part where he said, does it constitute cruel and unusual punishment or whatever? I don't say that it does that. Does it open up new avenues for legal challenges? I think it does do that. I think it shows that the internet publication with address specific and with the type of detail that it does, I think it bolsters the claims that the internet is a dangerous tool, and it's a government-aided tool that allows the public to engage in vigilante. I mean, I think it moves our cause forward. And in terms of the jury, I think you might be right that a jury won't convict them. If you remember when they took the person to jail, you remember that they applauded. He received an ovation upon being admitted to jail. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And I have some clips from the change.org campaign to help fund his legal defense to read off, most of which just say things like, he's a hero. He has saved all of us from these terrible people and, you know, doing things that the government won't do and protecting our children, et cetera.
Well, now, but just think about the absurdity of this. A jail facility full of people who the majority are generally pre-trial, pre-conviction. These are people who want to be presumed not guilty. They want to have a good attorney. They'd like to have a robust challenge against the state and hold the state's feet to the fire in terms of burden of proof. How is it that they could rationally do what they did and claim that they want due process of law for themselves? If you can explain that to me, I'll take you to the thickest steak or whatever you want to eat while I'm here, because I cannot fathom how that you could be in jail and applaud someone being admitted to jail who's just committed or been accused of, we don't know he's guilty, but accused of committing a very serious crime. To me, I can't make that calculate.
Do you think from Judge Mach pointing out that the registry is cruel and unusual punishment at the hands of the public, do you think that ties into it?
Ties into?
Just the aspect of what you said is that here's the internet component, that we have this public registry thing, and because of public registry thing, dude got killed. And does that make any of the connection for you?
Well, I don't remember vigilantism being a part of Judge Mach's decision. He was not focused on that, so I'm not drawing the direct parallel there. And Judge Mach, for those who would not recognize the name, that was the now deceased federal judge in Colorado who found that the registry as applied to the challenging parties was unconstitutional in several regards, and one was that it caused cruel and unusual punishment. There was more than one plaintiff, and I don't remember which one he found that was cruel and unusual. It might have been the person who was convicted as a juvenile, but I don't quite see the parallel here.
Will is like determined that he's saying that three had been harassed, and Judge Mach called them out for it, that they had been harassed because of the public component of the registry, which then ties into this thing in Fairbanks in Omaha with Fairbanks and whatever it is, Condolucci, that because dude was on the internet, he was able to find out who he was and decided to go murder him.
Well, I know that before we sign off that people want me to say that that all registries are unconstitutional.
Sure.
And they're not.
Right.
All criminal registries are bad, but they're not all unconstitutional. You could have a registry that would be constitutional. Now, I don't think any of our legislative bodies would be capable of designing such a thing, because there'd be too much pressure to pile on things that would make it unconstitutional. But you could have a constitutional registry.
So, like, to take this Omaha thing by extension, so if it didn't give dudes 123 Main Street, but just said in the general vicinity of this intersection or in this county maybe, then dude would never have necessarily known that he lived next door. Plus, as I understand it, all of the registries say that you cannot use this for anything other than just your basic informational purposes. Like, you can't use this to go and be a vigilante. And dude killing another dude is, that, as far as I know, our criminal code shuns that kind of activity.
Yeah, it's already against the law. But if someone would break the law, do you think simply putting an admonishment that you shouldn't misuse this information, do you think that would do anything?
No, I certainly don't. But then does the judge, does he get, God, you would only have to have one person hold out, correct? To convict him of murder, would you just need one holdout?
Well, you need one holdout to acquit. I mean, to hang the jury, but.
Right. So then can the judge get in there to the jury and go, look, I don't care what you think about the registry, killing another human is bad. I mean, does the judge get to, like, I know the judge does a little bit with the jury as far as, like, here are the rules, here's what you're actually listening for. So did he do this, like, premeditated and all these things, and then they're all going to go, he's not guilty?
Well, I think I follow your question. Jury nullification doesn't happen very often. That's when, despite the evidence, the jury finds not guilty. You're correct. The judge would, in the instructions, and even before you get the instructions, in the vetting of the jury, you would be trying your hardest, if you're the defense, to make sure that those type of biases are not there. But you can have a runaway jury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all it takes is a really strong personality to emerge as the foreperson of the jury, and you can end up having a runaway jury, and people can do things that are irrational. But the evidence is pretty compelling So it's hard to imagine that he won't be found guilty of something. They may settle on a lesser charge because they identify with what he did and why he did it.
I mean, I can imagine scenarios where you walk into your bedroom and your spouse is there with your best friend and you lose your brain and you kill them in the heat of the moment. This guy kind of pondered it for days and he went to the dude's door and knocked on it and talked to him for a second and just said, I was just overcome with rage and I just shot him right there on the spot. It feels a little bit less than just I was overcome with rage and anger at the moment.
No, it sounds very premeditated to
it. It does. It's at least maybe not premeditated to the point of, but hey, I'm going to go have a talk with this dude. Okay. I can't handle it anymore. I just must kill this person. It's so ridiculous. Plus, have you seen dude's mustache?
Yes.
That is an amazing mustache. Condolucci has one of those 1920s things that curls up and around a few times over.
Looks like a weirdo.
I really struggle to think. I can see the jury saying that maybe he shouldn't be guilty, but I don't know how they could argue. God, it would be, to me, that would be some mental gymnastics to sit there and go, he's not guilty of ending the person's life. So maybe they come back with some lesser kind of murder. I know that there's 10 different kinds of murder that there is, but somebody's still dead at this.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine a totally not guilty, but they could cut him some slack and he could be found guilty without the premeditation. But you know, the evidence is strong.
Very well. And then if you are not in objection to any, if there are any other articles to cover, I would like to do the challenge to the Miami Sex Offender Residency Rules and then call it quits.
Sure.
Unless there's something else you want to hit.
No problem.
Ruvi. So this one comes from Courthouse News. Panel here is challenged to Miami sex offender residency rules. And I always love when I read articles that have Lauren or Ron Book in it because they just seem to have such a, like their public image is like, oh, we're trying to help the offenders, but they are putting the screws to them at every turn. And this is about residents, PFRs, just having to be, for all practical purposes, homeless and with nowhere else to go. And I was hoping that you had some information that you could fill in the gaps on where this may be heading.
Well, I didn't get the chance to. So what we have is an appeal in the 11th Circuit. And for those who haven't followed it, the 11th Circuit is in the Southeast United States. It's based in Atlanta, and it covers three states, Georgia, Florida, Alabama. It's one of the circuit courts of the United States court system. So when you try a case at the district court level and you're an unsatisfied party, you have a right by law to appeal to the 11th Circuit. So the challenge was filed against the 2,500 feet requirement prohibition for, it's not all offenders, it's certain sex offenders, but the prohibition that makes it difficult to find housing in Miami-Dade. And the district judge said, nope. This is constitutional, so it's on appeal. The 11th Circuit, just FYI, has been sitting on a case out of Alabama, which is one of the three states in the circuit, McGuire versus Strange. And that's been sitting in the 11th Circuit for a number of years now. And those who attended the NARSL National Conference, the webinar, or whatever we call it these days, one of the attorneys on that case, Phil Telfayon, was a speaker.
Yep.
And I don't know if that came up. I have not been able to watch any of the conference.
Yeah, he talked about it pretty much exclusively for the hour that he was on.
Yes. Well, that case has been sitting there unresolved. So my expectation would be that based on the track record of the 11th Circuit, this case may go some time before it's resolved on the appeal.
Can you enlighten me on what I have no idea what they do. Do they play golf all day? What is the holdup of them deciding on a case for years and years and years?
Well, we don't know on this one. It could be anything from a member of the panel died, or had health issues. They assigned the cases to three judge panels. And, it could be anything from that to there's an evolving body of case law and registration and they're waiting to see if the silver bullet they're looking for to either give them the backup to to strike the thing or to uphold it, you know, in the case of McGuire versus Strange. So it could be any number of things. But someday they will eventually decide the case.
It's just not this day.
who knows when, but they will eventually decide the case. And the same thing with the Tenth Circuit in the case that you just mentioned earlier with Judge Mage. The Tenth Circuit's been sitting for some time on that case. They will eventually decide the case.
2,500 feet is...
It's half a mile.
It is half a mile, but it doesn't, like, you know, half a mile as the crow flies. Like, that's a 7-8 minute walk, you know, at not even anything of a brisk pace. It's not that far, but when you turn it into a big circle, it is a gigantic number of square feet that now is off limits. It's so crazy at how big that is, that in a place like Miami-Dade, like, that is a very congested place that there is now effectively no place for them to live except for this tiny little carve out. And then when they go there, they run them off, and now they've got to go find some little other carve out for them to go hang out at. And somehow, so this, the original judge says, nope, you can do this.
That's what, and I looked at the 45 page opinion, which I may have read back in 18 when it came out, but I don't recall enough details to talk intelligently about it. But I'm sure that the judge felt that he or she had done a brilliant analysis for coming up with because just because you don't like something doesn't make it unconstitutional. And what you're arguing is banishment. And the issue of banishment, as it was understood in colonial times, which those who claim they're literalists and believe interpret by what the words would have meant at the time, banishment didn't include just not being able to live at a place. Banishment included being told to leave town and never come back. So the defense of these laws is they say, well, we haven't banished them from town. They can spend money. They can be here. This is not a banishment. This is merely that they cannot live here. Or they can live here, but they have to live within the boundaries of what's acceptable. But it's not a true banishment. So then you have to come up with a new legal theory. And a good legal theory is not that I don't like this law, this bad public policy. That doesn't make it unconstitutional. Bad public policies don't magically become unconstitutional because you disagree with them.
I disagree, Larry, and we should not allow this.
So that's what people who don't understand what the court's role is, their court's role is not to save us from unwise choices that we've imposed on ourselves through a democratic process.
Stupid but constitutional.
Yes, I think we need to play Scalia. Do you have that handy?
Oh, my God. It would take me moments to get there. So vamp for a minute, Larry, and I will find stupid but constitutional.
So, but yeah, when we have bad laws from a policy perspective, that doesn't make them unconstitutional. You have to put forth the constitutional argument. Like, it deprives the one that I'm chomping at the bit is the religious separation of the First Amendment, where people are effectively not allowed to go to church. The law doesn't say you can't go to church, but the government, by prohibiting a person who's required to register from being within a certain number of feet, includes a worship house, and the worship house ought to step forward and say, nope, that's not none of your business. The government is not allowed to constitutionally separate us from our parishioners. So therefore, we've got a constitutional argument. But just because you don't like the fact that there's an exclusion zone, unless they did it retroactively and took your property from you, at first blush, it doesn't look unconstitutional because it's not a banishment. It's a restriction.
Do you remember if it was the clip that was about originalism? The constitution that I apply is not living but dead, or on defense of marriage.
I don't remember. We don't want to look for it tonight.
Yeah, I don't know which one it is. I should probably get that as just a little itty bitty one little thing.
We're at the end of our time allocation.
We are. Absolutely. We're at 140.
So
that is all I've got, Larry, unless you have anything else that you would like to talk about, plug, discuss, describe.
Well, I would like to know, if someone wanted to support the podcast or contact the podcast, how do they do it?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, your answer is always going to be very careful. However, first of all, you have to go get internet, and there is no internet here at this location. It is garbage. So from here, these people could not support us. However, other people could go to patreon.com/registrymatters. And of course, we love all of our listeners, but the ones that support us, you guys are the bestest in the whole world, and we so very much appreciate it. It makes this a much more enjoyable endeavor, and it makes the pockets a little bit heavier, I guess. Yeah, heavier. And there's another stimulus check coming, Larry. So maybe we could entice people to give us the new stimulus check.
Well, we'll have to wait and see about that.
How long are you in town for?
Till next weekend.
Excellent. And traveling was good. How did you have an interesting experience at Hartsfield?
Just a little 3-hour stayover, but no, Hartsfield was the only thing interesting was there was nobody in it.
Nobody in it. I don't know. Like some time ago, I flew out of there like at Thanksgiving, and the security line was like wrapped all the way around the food court.
I didn't need to go through it because I was barely passing through, but sure. I can imagine it was not very. I didn't encounter any problems along the way in terms of security delays. It was running with fewer personnel, but it was running pretty rapidly.
And Will wants me to ask you: you did bring the shower head?
I did. I had to use it. I couldn't get a drop of water in Raleigh.
Did you? You didn't go to Raleigh?
Yes, I did.
You did go to Raleigh?
Yes, that was my first stop.
Oh, and that's why you went. You were telling me about. Okay, now I understand. I didn't really. I thought you were being silly when you talked about. Oh, never mind. Okay, I thought you ran into somebody somewhere else. I got it.
So.
All right then. Well, that is going to close things out. The show notes will be at registrymatters.co. You can find YouTube. You can call in at 747-227-4477 and registrymatterscast@gmail.com. There you go. That's everything.
So thanks, everyone.
Have a great night, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.